Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. They say that the two constants in everyone's life are death and taxes. This week, we explore the first, the history of American attitudes toward death. It may not be the lightest topic we've taken up on this show, but it is among the most interesting. And later, Norman Markowitz will give us his historical perspective on the current move toward Social Security reform. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On July 11, 1804, Vice President Aaron Burr killed former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton in a duel near Weehawken, New Jersey. During the American Revolution, Burr served on the staff of General George Washington. Before he practiced law, was elected to the New York State Legislature and won election to the U.S. Senate. In 1797, however, in the first of a series of run-ins with Hamilton, Burr's re-election to the Senate was blocked by Hamilton's considerable political opposition. In 1800, Burr tied Thomas Jefferson in electoral votes for the presidency of the United States. The contest was taken to the House of Representatives, where Hamilton's opposition once again led to Burr's defeat. He assumed the office of vice president, but not content with that, 4 years later, Burr ran for election to the New York State governorship, where, you guessed it, he was successfully blocked by the former Treasury Secretary. When Burr learned Hamilton had disseminated letters containing derogatory comments about him, he challenged Hamilton to the duel that took Hamilton's life. Even though Burr was still vice president, warrants were issued for his arrest. He fled to Philadelphia, where he took up with General James Wilkinson, a U.S. Army officer who was secretly in the pay of Spain, plotting an invasion of Mexico, and some suspected fomenting a secessionist movement in the West. When Wilkinson betrayed Burr to federal authorities, Burr was arrested and tried for treason. He was acquitted, but he remained under a cloud of suspicion for the rest of his life. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, when the movie 13 Days about the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis was screened recently in Moscow for a group of senior Soviet participants in the Cold War, the Americans in attendance learned that the crisis was even more dangerous than they thought. In a question-and-answer session that followed, the retired commander of the Soviet submarine sent toward Cuba at the time told an incredulous former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, "We had 22 torpedoes on each submarine, and one of those torpedoes on each ship had a nuclear warhead." You remember the movie scene when the Soviet ships turned back when faced with our naval blockade, McNamara commented, "Well, it turns out they had nuclear weapons aimed at our ships, and we had no idea." Despite misgivings in Moscow, Pentagon investigators are intensifying their search for Cold War-era Russian records that could confirm reports that American servicemen from World War II and the Korean War were held and died in the network of labor camps known as the Gulag. The Russian government is cooperating with the effort, but it is deeply skeptical of the evidence made available so far, mainly eyewitness accounts with limited details and little or no documentation. This is Talking History. We don't like to think about it, but in fact, our thoughts on death have changed over the centuries. So too have our funeral practices. And both are the subject of this week's conversation between Talking History's Eileen Dugan and her guest, Gary Letterman.
It has often been said that one of the best ways to understand a society is to study how it treats death and the dead. How do people perceive death? What are their funeral practices, and how and why do they change over time? With us today to discuss early American attitudes toward death is Dr. Gary Letterman, Associate Professor of Religion at Emory University. Dr. Letterman is the author of The Sacred Remains, American Attitudes Toward Death, 1799 to 1883, and the forthcoming Death in Modern America, A Cultural History of the American Funeral Industry. Welcome, Dr. Letterman.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to start with the question that friends and family no doubt have asked you. What attracted you to the topic of death and early American funeral practices?
Yeah, I do get asked that quite a bit, and I wish I had a real fantastic answer, like my dad was a funeral director, or I grew up near a cemetery, but it's not the case. It's purely out of my education and intellectual interests as an undergraduate. When I was a psychology major and taking courses on Freud, but also courses in existentialism and some many religion courses. And it became pretty quickly clear to me that what better topic to study if you're interested in human psychology, human interaction, human aspirations to make meaning out of the world. And it's really in my undergraduate years that that topic came to me, I suppose.
And why did you choose this particular period for the Sacred Remains?
Well, when I was a graduate student at the University of California, Santa Barbara, I wanted to continue to study death and knew it would be the topic for my dissertation. And I also knew that I wanted to study American religious history. So as I read through the literature on death in America, one point that I kept reading was that the Civil War was a very important moment in death in America. But in most of what was already published on the topic, there was no real analysis of the Civil War and its meaning and impact in American history. And that's what eventually led me to conceptualize the dissertation as an exploration of how the Civil War is a watershed event.
And you begin your Sacred Remains book in 1799 and the early 19th century and Washington's funeral. How did Americans view death and burial at the turn of the 19th century?
Well, from much of the material that I found, and there's obviously a great deal of variation among different communities, but in general, in the community I studied, which was basically white, northern, Protestant communities, and that's pretty broad, there was a very close familiarity and intimacy with the dead within local communities. Death was very much a very common dimension of everyday life. And so people were very familiar with and aware of death and close to dead bodies. For the most part, rituals surrounding burial were family affairs. They were community affairs. And different parts of the community would play, in general, different roles. There would be people who could build a coffin. Often cabinet makers and carpenters were involved in this field early on. Also, stable owners would be involved in terms of providing the means of transportation during a funeral. But the family would be involved washing the body, getting it ready, preparing it. Occasionally there would be people in the community, often older women, who would have that role in some cases. But it was a community affair.
And in terms of Washington's funeral, what happened there?
Well, with Washington, his funeral was, I think, a significant moment in the nation's history. And by his stature as one of the leading figures in American revolutionary history during the Revolutionary War and after, his death signaled a moment of national community in ways in which I think a very formative emerging concept of a national community was taking shape, and his death provided Americans a rallying point around which to both conceptualize their own self-identity, but also to enact rituals that in concrete form brought the nation together. So communities all over the country were involved in various funeral rituals that commemorated Washington's passing.
How did funerals go to be from being very private affairs to being much more public?
I think that funerals have always been a combination of both in some ways, both private and public, because funerals, even before the Civil War, had a very public component. And for me, in terms of my, well, some would say really macabre interests, I mean in terms of the visibility of the body or the corpse, so that the body would be on public display, and there would be a integral moment in most funeral ceremonies where people would have a chance to see the body. It would be sort of written into the cultural script of funerals. And that would be a moment of bringing a certain, you know, a kind of a public community together.
Who were the first layers out of the dead, as in Philadelphia? I mean, what did they do?
They were primarily an emerging class of people who offered their services at the time of death and began to offer their services publicly through advertising, through listings in various areas of the community. They would publicize what they do and that they had services to offer the public. Their services pretty much included preparing the body for the funeral. So they would try to wash the body, try to prepare the body by dressing it, arranging for the coffin, taking care of at a very minimal level some of the details that were beginning to become very complicated in the funeral process and in the, you know, ultimate disposal of the dead.
Were they involved in this time in embalming or in cosmetic touch-up of the body?
Well, not really embalming, not before the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
They would use some cosmetics. They would try to find a way to make the body presentable for this last look. That would include, you know, a lot of this would take place, would have to take place within a span of 2 or 3 days, and depending on the climate and the conditions where the body is located. But they would try to keep it cool, and they would try to, yeah, dress it up, comb the hair, get the face and the upper part of the body ready to be displayed.
You've mentioned already that the Civil War was a watershed in terms of American attitudes towards death. Why?
Well, there are a number of reasons, but one key reason that I try to emphasize at the end of the book, the emergence of embalming, which comes out of the experience of the Civil War primarily, and really just transforms the landscape of death at the end of the 19th and really throughout the 20th century. Embalming, at least as I see it, becomes a necessary, fundamental ingredient of the emergence of a funeral industry that encounters unbelievable success throughout the 20th century.
And what role, too, did battlefield photography play in American attitudes towards death?
Well, that also, I think there are many ways in which the Civil War made an impact on people's views of death and experience of death, and not just the rituals, but how we conceptualize death. And because photography was able to transmit images of battlefield carnage, sometimes images that were doctored for aesthetic reasons by photographers, it brought a kind of vision of war and bloodshed and carnage to the American public. I mean, even though, you know, Civil War obviously was taken place on American soil, so the people in various communities would be able to go and walk on the battlefields and see bodies up close and personal, but photographies allowed for a wider dissemination of these images. And I think they're unprecedented in terms of American exposure to this kind of horrific visions of death and bodies. So it, in a way, it opened up a medium for imagining death and visualizing death that is, for many, a kind of distinctive element of photography in general, but also the theme of death. And as we see today, the kind of association between violence and death and sort of mass carnage in films and on television as visual kinds of representations, I think are going to the popularity that was seen after these photographs of the Civil War made their way on the American scene.
We're all, of course, very familiar with the story of Lincoln's assassination, but I think less of us are familiar with the story of how Lincoln's death was handled. Could you tell us a little something about that?
Sure. Lincoln's death is a bookend this book with Washington at the beginning and then Lincoln at the end. And Lincoln's funeral is another critical part of the story because he's assassinated, of course, and then his body is taken away from Mary Todd Lincoln and taken over by funeral professionals, undertakers, men who make a living in disposing of the dead. And they took care of the body and embalmed it and got it ready for what would be a journey across the northern states, primarily from Washington, D.C. to Springfield, with various stops in different cities where the body itself would be put on display so that, you know, going back to the beginning of the book in Washington's funeral, there were a number of commemorations, as I mentioned, but all of them had an invisible body. In other words, there was no real body present, even though they would have a casket, an empty casket. Here, in Lincoln's case, the body was actually available and made available for hundreds of thousands of Americans to see, many making pilgrimages, so that you can think of his body as a traveling sacred site that brings people together, people who want to see, but do more than see. I mean, they engage in the communal ritual actions that help to rejuvenate national identity and national bonds of kinship. And I think his body did that for, obviously, for the North, primarily. But there's also interesting dimensions to his traveling body as well that have to do with the fact that many reported on how poorly the body was looking, especially after the first few days. So there was a kind of alternative discourse that was more critical of embalming and that was more critical of the emerging national consensus that was taking place around his body. And I think I try to show the connections between the individual body and the social body.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. Latterman.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. Gary Latterman, Associate Professor of Religion at Emory University and author of The Sacred Remains, American Attitudes Toward Death, 1799 to 1883.
From the date of its creation nearly 70 years ago, Social Security has been the constant target of critics and naysayers. For the past several years, many have predicted its imminent demise through bankruptcy, and that includes the Bush administration, which has called for major reforms. Rutgers history professor Norman Markowitz offers us a historical cautionary note.
Is Social Security on its way to bankruptcy? Most likely not. Given the increase in the velocity of change in a globalized economy, policies based on such predictions, like legislation to mandate balanced budgets, can only serve to force governments into inflexible policies incapable of responding to rapid change. It is more logical to conclude, as Social Security's defenders argue, that the system's trust funds are safe far into the 21st century. Supporting this position are continued asset growth and, most important, a projected long-term decrease in need in the post-baby boomer era as declining birth rates catch up to declining death rates. Unlike programs in other industrial countries that serve as the primary source of retirement income, Social Security in the United States has long functioned as a supplementary safety net. In the first half of the 20th century, a large and powerful insurance industry strengthened the opposition of employers to extending social insurance. World War II then produced tax legislation that gave employers a powerful incentive to reduce tax liability by establishing pension plans. Cold War tax policy and the anti-labor Taft-Hartley Law of 1947 then induced a weakened post-war labor movement to focus its collective bargaining on fringe benefits, primarily pension and health insurance plans for members, rather than on such political action as improving Social Security. Taken together, these factors produced the present public-private multi-tier system in the United States. Even so, for tens of millions of low-income people, Social Security is their only pension. They are the ones who need relief from the sharp increases in the 1980s and 1990s in payroll taxes. At the same time, cost of living adjustments have been reduced and the retirement age set higher. Attacks on the system over the last 20 years by the same forces who today champion privatization have made it more regressive for younger and lower income workers. Liberal and labor defenders of Social Security now need to do more than merely contend that the system isn't broke, so why fix it? For example, they could advocate supplementing Social Security trust funds through general revenues, a step most of the system's architects foresaw. This would reduce regressive payroll taxes and provide a real and lasting tax cut, while making the system more equitable for younger workers. Liberals and labor should insist that the partial privatization pushed by the Bush administration would very likely produce a state-sponsored version of the mutual funds of the 1920s, in which millions invested for their retirement only to see the funds crash with the stock market in 1929. If history is any guide, the warnings about Social Security going under can be discounted. Instead, we should seize the opportunity to enact reforms that will make the existing system more just, not transform it into something it was never intended to be. Turning Social Security into a mechanism for pouring compulsory retirement funds into the stock market would threaten the pensions of low-income retirees and provide a bonanza for those whom Franklin Roosevelt once called economic royalists, the rich and super-rich of today.
Norman Markowitz's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. Each summer, Talking History identifies historic sites you might wish to visit during your summer travels. This week, we recommend 7 Iowa villages that take you back in time to 19th century America. Here to tell you about them is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Born of a religious and social movement in 18th century Europe that came to the U.S. in the 19th century, the 7 villages of the Amana colonies in Iowa recapture time. The villages were founded by German-speaking settlers in 1855 who belonged to a religious group known as the Community of True Inspiration. The 7 villages that make up the Amana colonies are situated along the Iowa River. The colonies were known for their calico plant and woolen and flour mills and the products produced by the commune. In 1932, what is known as the Great Change took place in the colonies, and members created a joint stock company to run the businesses for profit. To date, the Amana Society Incorporated continues to own and manage some 26,000 acres of farm, pasture land, and forest. The best place to start your tour of the colonies is at the Museum of Amana History, which is made up of three 19th-century buildings. Another popular stop is the Amana Woolen Mill, where you can watch the looms in action. And don't worry about finding any restaurants while you're there. The German cooking served family style is famous. It is recommended you visit the official website, amanacolonies.com, before you visit for an online guide to the area. Go for the food, go for the crafts, go for the history. Amana Colonies is well worth the trip.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we call your attention to a new exhibit at the Chicago Historical Society, Portraits from the Golden Age of Jazz. During the 1930s and 1940s, William Gottlieb photographed a contemporary jazz scene to illustrate his columns in the Washington Post and Downbeat magazine. He captured such jazz greats as Duke Ellington, Betty Goodman, Henry James, Thelonious Monk, and Billie Holiday. Portraits from the Golden Age of Jazz, which closes September 8th, features 71 of Gottlieb's captivating images. And while you're at the Chicago Historical Society, check out The American Presidency, A Glorious Burden, a traveling exhibit prepared by the Smithsonian National Museum of American History that chronicles the lives of the men who have occupied the highest office in the land. The American Presidency closes September 2nd. And that's it for another week of Talking History. Hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian Laveau.